Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, the research leader of a UK and a Changing Europe funded research project that looks into what Brexit means for UK citizens living in the EU27. I'm recording this introduction today from Toulouse on the 29th of March 2018. And I'm reminded today on the anniversary of Article 50 of why it's more important now than ever to try and challenge those representations of British populations living in Europe that we're so familiar with. So my message today, and will be for a long time, is let's try and change the conversation about UK citizens who've made their homes and lives in the EU27. And I hope that listening to these podcasts, you're getting a sense of the diversity of those lives and the diverse impacts that Brexit is likely to have for those lives. So yes, join us in changing the conversation. My introduction today is to Professor Mary Gilmartin. Mary is a professor in geography based at Maynooth University in Ireland, and she's the author of Ireland and Migration in the 21st Century, which was published by Manchester University Press in 2015. And as part of the research for that book and some of the other work that she's been doing, she's come across an invisible population, and that's the population of UK citizens who have moved to Ireland for a variety of different reasons. I think it's really interesting within the context of thinking about where British people are settling in the EU27 that we very rarely think of Ireland. And yet, because of the long history between those two countries, between Ireland and the UK, and the migration flows between those two states, they're actually a large number, well, within the context of British migrants living elsewhere in Europe, there are a large number of UK citizens who settled in Ireland. The most recent statistics, the statistics from Eurostat, will tell you that 112,000 UK citizens live in Ireland. And those are people who do not hold dual nationality. All of those people are excluded. And various other UK-born people who wouldn't be counted. So that means that Ireland is the third most popular destination for UK citizens who are moving within the EU27. Certainly on this podcast, we have focused a lot on France and Spain because, of course, those are the areas that Karen and I are most familiar with from our previous research. But I think it's time that we change the conversation and thought a little bit about why it might be that we know so much less about UK citizens living in Ireland than we do about UK citizens living in other states, and indeed why even within Ireland this isn't really a topic of conversation. I started by asking Mary to reflect a little on why the British and Ireland are overlooked within discussions about migration in Ireland.
I think the ease of mobility between Ireland and Britain is part of the explanation. So the common travel area between Ireland and Britain means, and it's been this way since really after World War II, that Irish citizens can move to Britain or British citizens can move to Ireland and have pretty much the same rights in terms of voting rights, access to services in those countries that they have in their home country. So when you move from Britain to Ireland, I think it can sometimes be difficult for people to understand that as migration in the way that migration is often framed, because the language is similar, the cultural references are similar, and when you move, you don't face the difficulties that people do in other countries, for example, registration, having delays and getting access to services and so on. So the common travel area, the ease of movement and circular migration between the two countries mean that sometimes people don't understand it or experience it as migration in the way that migration is often spoken about or thought about.
That brings me really neatly onto my next question, which is, what is the common travel area?
The common travel area is an agreement between Britain and Ireland, which dates to the period just after the Second World War, when Ireland became an independent state and left the Commonwealth. And at that time, it was decided, I think, by the governments that in order to protect particularly the population of Ireland and Britain, but also the British population in Ireland, that Irish people in Britain would be treated effectively as British citizens and vice versa. So that's a kind of informal agreement. People can find it quite difficult to point to the precise legislation or the precise way in which it's ingrained in law. But it's an agreement that facilitates that movement and that taking up of residence. In a way, I mean, those kinds of agreements occur between many proximate countries. So between Australia and New Zealand, between the US and Canada in different forms, recognizing the reality of regular movement over and back across those borders.
It's almost as though it's a freedom of movement before there was freedom of movement within the European Union.
Totally. The common travel area predates the European Union. And so right now, as the Brexit talks are going on, the status of the common travel area is one that people are paying attention to. I don't think there's any desire, at least from an Irish perspective, to make any fundamental changes to what already exists because of the common travel area.
Yes, I found a document yesterday that was produced by the Irish Department for Foreign Affairs on Brexit and Ireland's priorities within it. And it describes the common travel area in this way. It says, this allows for freedom of movement across the islands. It also allows Irish and UK citizens to access various services and benefits in each country, such as to reside, to work, to access public services, and to vote in certain elections. In many cases, the benefits have subsequently been matched, subsumed within, or overtaken by rights conferred under EU law. And it goes on later in the document to stress, our objective is to ensure that the current CTA arrangements continue in the event of the UK leaving the EU. Now, my understanding is that the Irish government's desire to maintain this is linked not only, of course, to the free movement of Irish people to Britain and British people to Ireland, but is fundamentally linked to the Northern Ireland peace process and the questions about that border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. Do you think that's a correct evaluation?
Yeah, absolutely. The Good Friday Agreement enshrined the right of people who were born in Northern Ireland to be Irish citizens. So if people are living in Northern Ireland and are Irish citizens, any idea that they wouldn't have the rights of citizens and would be subject to border control in crossing from Northern Ireland to the Republic of Ireland would create all kinds of difficulties. So obviously the status of Northern Ireland remains contested. And one of the ways in which the Good Friday Agreement and the aftermath of the Good Friday Agreement in relation to the peace process has worked is to try and maintain the connections around citizenship and nationality and to ensure that they are also linked to freedom of movement and freedom of residence. So it is absolutely connected to Northern Ireland, but it's also connected to the numbers of Irish people living in Britain. I think it's about 400,000 people born in Ireland are living in Britain.
That's quite a large number, quite a lot larger than that number of British people that are understood to be living in Ireland. Moving on to that, going back to that question of UK citizens living in Ireland, what do we know about them?
Well, we know quite a bit from various censuses. And so as a migrant population, British people living in Ireland are very different to other migrant populations in Ireland. Their age profile matches the age profile of Irish nationals. So younger people, people of working age, and also older people. We know that in terms of the class profile and in terms of occupation, that again, it's a really similar structure to Irish nationals. So people working across a whole range of occupations and in a range of different classes. One interesting thing that we know is that British migrants in Ireland are more likely to be living in rural areas and along the western seaboard than other migrant groups. So we can see urban concentrations of some migrant groups, you know, in Dublin or in Cork and so on. That's less the case for British migrants, but there's clearly also a very strong concentration of people from Britain who are working, who are professionals working in Dublin. So, for example, in the IT services, in healthcare, in education, and so on. So it's an interesting profile because it's actually, as a population, very diverse.
That's really fascinating about the geographical dispersion of that UK citizen population in Ireland. That wasn't actually something that I had considered, particularly when you said that, you know, largely speaking, the demographics of that population mirror that of the Irish population. I mean, is there any further detail about those statistics of British people living in those kind of more rural coastal areas?
Well, there's certainly a sense that some of it is countercultural migration. So it's people moving to rural areas for a specific kinds of lifestyles. So that's one aspect. And that's a kind of migration stream that probably has been happening since the 1960s or 70s. But there's also a strong sense that it's connected to emigration from Ireland to Britain. That population in the rural areas is often older, and it's often British people living in mixed nationality relationships or households with Irish people. So my speculation from that is that it's couples with one Irish partner who emigrated from rural Ireland to Britain, forming a relationship with somebody with British nationality and then returning to rural Ireland, to near where the Irish person grew up or lived previously.
So a kind of return retirement migration.
Yeah, return retirement migration, which then raises its own issues because, of course, particularly since austerity in Ireland, there's been a defunding of a lot of public services and rural areas have been particularly hit. So if you have an older population and if you have people who are retirement migrants in this rural area, then the possibility for experiences of exclusion or inequality or lack of access or limited access to healthcare is particularly high.
Well, that's really, yeah, so it's got all of those knock-on effects in relation to migrant integration, I suppose, at the point of accessing services, at the point of the welfare state, all of those issues that we do think about when we're talking about migration.
I think so, and it's one of the issues then when a population isn't identified as a migrant population, that the particular challenges that it faces, that population faces in particular parts of the country where they've settled, are not visible and then are not addressed.
That again, that actually lends itself very well to the kind of discussion of the invisibility of that population in migration discourse in Ireland, which is something that you have written about in your work. Would you like to explain a little bit more about how you interpret that invisibility?
Yeah, I think that the research projects that I worked on, so particularly a project with my colleague Bettina Migge, where we wanted to talk to recent migrants to Ireland about their experiences of being migrants and to talk to people repeatedly, so to get a sense of how that changed over time. We had become a bit concerned with how migration to Ireland was being framed and with the very limited way in which that category of migrant was being defined in Ireland. So in order to address that, rather than looking for particular national groups or for particular occupations or so on, we sought people to participate in the project based on the year that they arrived in Ireland. And we didn't set out specifically to target British people, but it happened that maybe about 20% of the people that we spoke to were British migrants. And by talking to people and getting a sense of their experiences, we began to realize that actually the story of British migrants in Ireland is a really important story to tell, but it's not being told. So why then was it not being told? And in part, we were speculating that it was to do with this constant movement between Ireland and Britain in the way that meant that people didn't think of the movement itself as migration. That has long links, I suppose, to the colonial period when, of course, Ireland was part of the United Kingdom. So movement between the two wouldn't have been considered international migration. But it also raised issues around Irish identity and the extent to which Irish identity and Irish nationality was framed in opposition to Britain, particularly during the Troubles. And so it meant that drawing attention to the very strong presence of British people in Ireland raised challenging questions about Irish identity and about the Irish relationship to Britain.
So what you're saying there is that it was an uncomfortable truth that there were lots of British people living in Ireland at that time. And so that's why it was easier to look away from that. Is that fair as an interpretation of what you've just said?
I think that's a very fair interpretation. And I think as well that the reality that many people living in Ireland who had moved from Britain had a connection to Ireland, an ethnic connection. They may have had parents or grandparents who were Irish. They may identify as Irish. They identified as Irish with British accents was something that created difficulties or an uncomfortableness for many people in Ireland as well. So being able to recognize the reality of the relationship between Britain and Ireland through migration and through migrant experiences was a very difficult challenge when people were framing Irish identity in oppositional terms rather than through those connections.
Absolutely. That's really fascinating. I mean, it links into a lot of those questions about migration, identity, and these kind of long histories of relationships between countries, between nations, and what that can then do, particularly when there are large, you know, very long and very long histories of travel and trade and communication between populations. So I think, though, you've also written about the kind of invisibility of these British populations in contemporary Irish migration discourse. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
British people tend not to be identified as migrants. It's as simple as that. So when we speak about migration in contemporary Ireland, particular tropes are used to, I suppose, represent migrants. And it's understanding migration as happening from accession countries, so Poland in particular, to the extent that people who come from other accession countries are often described as Polish, much to their frustration in an Irish context. And there's also a way of framing migration and migrants as racially distinct or racially different without necessarily using the term race, so to point to particular nationalities, whether those are a range of African nationalities or Asian nationalities, as a synonym for migrant and for race in that context. So British people are not talked about as migrants. And in common discussion and in common interaction, when British people assert their migrant status, they're often not believed. So there's this sort of uncomfortable relationship, I suppose, in a way, where British people are clearly migrants to Ireland, though in the hierarchy of migrants, so the migrants with the most rights in Ireland, they are still migrants and they still don't have full voting rights and have difficulties accessing some services in particular. But in the migrant hierarchy, they are not quite migrants.
You intimated earlier that invisibility of that British population within Ireland's understanding of who its migrants are is actually a little problematic in terms of the life experiences of those British populations in Ireland. Can you reflect on that a bit?
So we noticed it when we were interviewing people about their experiences of living in Ireland. And it was really quite moving when people spoke about the times that they'd been targeted for being English or British, the times when they'd been in public spaces and were afraid to speak because it would draw attention to themselves. And often for people who felt a connection to Ireland through relatives or through times that they'd spent in Ireland as children on summer holidays, the idea that they were not being considered as Irish or as having Irish identity was something that was deeply upsetting to them. We also noticed people speaking about the efforts that they'd made to understand Irish society, Irish culture, and Irish history, and how their attempts to talk about that would be, I suppose, undermined or laughed at in a variety of places. And certainly for me, listening to those stories made me reconsider what it meant to be British in Ireland. obviously there's a long history of perhaps unwelcome British presence in Ireland. But for many of these people who were trying to live lives that made them contributing parts of the communities that they were resident in, the challenges that they faced because of particular understandings of national identity were definitely very poignant.
I think that that's another thing that points towards the importance of understanding these populations as a migrant population.
I think so. There is a broader tendency to equate migration with poverty. Bridget Anderson's written about this in her recent book, Us and Them, where she says the term migrant has come to mean the global poor. But I think that the distinction between migrants and expats is not a useful one or a helpful one. And I think also our attempts to create hierarchies of migrants and not quite migrants isn't helpful. Because in a society like Ireland, when you move to Ireland, there's a lot that's unsaid or a lot that's unclear about how Irish society works. And those unwritten rules are as opaque to many people moving from Britain as they are to people moving from other countries in Europe or outside Europe. So trying to recognize the difficulties that people face when they move to Ireland, regardless of their nationality or their assumed affinity or familiarity with Ireland, is a really important thing to do in Ireland and in other migrant receiving countries. And so to not recognize people from Britain as migrants places the burden on people from Britain for integration and for participation. And it's an unrealistic burden to place on people who move to a new country.
I think that's a really excellent and insightful analysis. I'm just wondering if you've got any insights on those British populations that you worked with on that previous project and what they are feeling and sensing in terms of Brexit. I wondered if you had any sense of that at all.
We haven't spoken to the people who took part in that project specifically about Brexit, but with another colleague, with Tricia Wood, we've been certainly looking at applications for Irish citizenship in the wake of Brexit, looking at the very...
Of course, those have gone up quite dramatically, haven't they?
Yes, and they've gone up not just from people who are living in Britain with Irish ancestry, but from a lot of British people living in Ireland. So anecdotally, we know from our colleagues, our friends and our connections that many British people living in Ireland who never felt the need to apply for Irish citizenship before are doing so, in some instances after 30 or 40 years of living in the country. So we're certainly seeing people who aren't ethnically Irish now identifying with Irish nationality in the post-Brexit time.
That's exactly the same as what's happening in France, which I found really fascinating. I never thought that I would see that happening to the extent that it is happening. And it's very, very clear that Brexit has been part of the motivation, or Brexit has signalled to them that now might be a good time to do that thing that they may have been thinking about for a while but never quite got round to doing. So I can fully understand that.
I think it was probably less urgent always in the Irish context because of the common travel area. But I think that the common travel area doesn't protect people in terms of mobility across Europe more broadly. And may also have forced people into declaring a different kind of allegiance. I think for people who are migrants, perhaps, Brexit may well have indicated a version of UK or British nationality that they may not have had an affinity with.
I think that that's certainly something that we're picking up in other cases of British populations living in Spain, in France and across the EU. And I also wonder whether there is something about Brexit as possibly marking a moment where, because of the potential changes to people's legal status, they are almost finding themselves in a situation where they themselves realise that they are migrants in very much in that legal sense of the idea of being a migrant.
I think so. And I think that the EU has made it possible to not acknowledge that for many years. So I think that the potential for leaving the EU in the aftermath of Brexit has forced many people to confront their particular status and the reality and impermanence, I suppose, of their positions in their new homes.
That's been absolutely fascinating, Mary. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. If you've enjoyed what we've been talking about today and want to find out more, check out our website, www.brexitbritsabroad.com, or you can follow us on social media via Twitter at BrexpatsEU and on Facebook. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And I'll speak to you again soon.